Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll get an update on the oil spill off the coast of Rhode Island and then examine ways to clean up such disasters. Scientists are now studying microorganisms which help to clean up spills and other contaminated sites. And then we'll look at so-called green investing. Nowadays, there are a host of funds which promise to invest your money in environmentally friendly companies. But how risky are they? Will they make you any money? Curly Bear Wagner, a Native American environmentalist from Montana, delivers a portrait of the Sweetgrass Prairie. And if you've ever slept through your alarm, try sleeping through a whole season. Our Earth calendar will look at grizzly bears, now in the middle of their sleep marathon. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Much of the world depends on oil, so it's not surprising when some of it spills. Unfortunately, spills create an environmental nightmare, killing wildlife and poisoning water. Earlier this month, a barge carrying heating oil ran aground off the coast of Rhode Island, and over 800,000 gallons spilled into the ocean. Although it's impossible to retrieve all of a spill, there are new ways to help ecosystems recover. Thomas Lally reports on one method used to clean up oil and other harmful substances.
The Trustum Pond National Wildlife Refuge sits on the southern shore of Rhode Island. It's a rare area of wilderness along the crowded northeast coast. Today, the refuge is in peril, suffering from the effects of hundreds of thousands of gallons of spilled heating oil. Nearly 100 birds have died, along with 43,000 pounds of lobsters and countless other creatures. Lionel Bryant is a spokesman for the Coast Guard, which is overseeing the recovery efforts. We reached him 4 days after the spill, when cleanup efforts were well underway. He says they're lucky that the oil is light.
The biggest thing we've concentrated on has been the barge. Most of the oil that's went into the water has really dissipated. We had like 828,000 gallons, and I would say more than 80% of it has either dissipated or evaporated. So what we're looking at now is very small sheens, which is almost impossible to actually, you know, pick up with any type of mechanical means. When they get into the marsh areas, we'll put down a pump to try to pump out the areas. We'll put down absorbent cloths to try to absorb up as much as possible. But that's pretty much what we're limited to. What you see is this, as it comes on shore, it's evaporating very, very quickly. And the best thing, we don't want to bring tractors in there to dig it up when it's right now it's not necessary to do that.
Experience with other spills has taught us that working with nature will speed recovery. There are organisms which, to put it crudely, eat oil and other toxins. These creatures occur naturally in the environment and have been used recently after such calamities as the Valdez oil spill. Professors Robin Ottenreith and Jim Bonner are a husband and wife team at Texas A&M University studying bioremediation, the process that uses nature to clean the environment after spills. Professor Ottenreith says nature has a way of cleaning itself, even when humans aren't involved.
Whether or not we do anything, it's going on. When I need a population of microorganisms to degrade a certain compound, I go to a site that's been exposed because the organisms are there.
But it's not that easy to just let nature take its course. Oil and other spills require intense cleanup efforts. Bioremediation is one tool, but it's a complicated process and often takes time to work. Efforts are underway to extend the reach of bioremediation. While Professor Bonner concentrates his research on bioremediation of oil spills, Ottenreith is working on ways to biodegrade substances for the U.S. Army, like explosives and nerve gas.
For hundreds of thousands of years, organisms have acclimated to the presence of oil. And so, yes, they do degrade it as indigenous species, as you mentioned before. But there are ways, we hope, to enhance this and increase the efficiency. And maybe Robin could address the issues of the munitions. That's a little bit more of a special case.
The munitions compounds are often called anthropogenic pollutants or xenobiotic compounds. Those are two catchwords frequently used. And what that indicates is that they are non-natural, that they are produced by human activities. So in the case of the nitroaromatic compounds, what we do is acclimate organisms, but they become naturally acclimated in the environment when exposed at levels that are not too toxic for them. So as Jim was saying, what we are attempting to do is determine what makes their life easier so that they are more effective in degrading what we call target compounds.
Bioremediation works by figuring out what organisms degrade what substances. Even poisons like PCBs are degraded by something. So once you have an organism, the job becomes how to encourage them to do their job. For Professor Bonner, this means releasing fertilizer into the San Jacinto River in Texas, where spilled oil is a constant problem from the refineries along the Houston Shipping Channel. Some have voiced concerns that encouraging the growth of these organisms may harm the environment if they begin to attack beneficial plants and animals. But Professor Bonner and Ottenreith say the chances of that happening are slim.
These organisms, if they're what we want them to do is be very efficient in degrading these target compounds. But once the target compound is gone, their source of food is gone. So unless they can very quickly adapt to something else, they're also going to be, their populations will decrease.
You would also stop your environmental manipulation at that point. Once the job's done, it's no longer economically viable to continue putting, say, chemical additions to the environment, so you would stop. And second, just like Robin said, after you remove the manipulation that allowed it to go to a greater extent, i.e. a non-limited condition, when you stop providing that for the organism, it will disappear. It's going to be consumed by zooplankton or just die of starvation and then become part of the carbon cycle.
We're just trying to make it a little bit easier for nature to take care of what's been dumped on it.
Bonner and Ottenreith's work centers around making the environment better for organisms that are already there. Other researchers are working on creating organisms in the laboratory targeted for specific jobs, though most of these creatures cannot withstand conditions in the field. But that may change. Bioremediation is getting more attention these days, partially because in some cases it's cheaper than other cleanup methods. For example, it's about a third less expensive than incineration for some compounds. One advantage is that you don't have to disturb the site very much to get the job done.
You can't burn material in an incinerator in place. You must first dig it up if it's in the ground or pump it, whatever, but put it into the incinerator. And oftentimes there is a tremendous amount of environmental exposure by actually picking the material up and putting it in an incinerator. For example, with New Bedford Harbor or the Hudson River, there's contaminated sediment. If you could work a method where you could bioremediate that material in situ, you wouldn't necessarily have the same exposure as coming along with a huge, you know, 500 horsepower hydraulic dredge, which would dig this material up and potentially stir it up, therefore exposing the environment, to get it in a hopper, which would then be pumped to the incinerator.
Bioremediation still has a long way to go before it can be relied upon as the primary means of cleanup of toxic substances. But it's hoped that it can be used to get to places humans cannot and to restore places like the Trustum Pond National Wildlife Refuge, which will likely feel the effects of the oil spill for many years to come. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
One of the ways some people have chosen to favorably impact the environment is through so-called green investing. This is where people invest in environmentally friendly companies or mutual funds. But do these green investments work? Mark Cohen, professor at the Owen Graduate School of Management at Vanderbilt University, says that a green investment means different things to different people.
Well, green investing, I think, is in the eyes of the beholder, quite frankly. To some people, it means screening firms that follow certain environmental practices that don't have certain environmental violations, screening firms out on the basis of their environmental performance. To others, it seems to mean taking on some sort of proactive, attempt to profit from trends in the environment, such that you'd invest in, let's say, environmental services industry, cleanup companies, whether they necessarily have a great environmental record themselves. And I think the third approach is to green investing, to some, is to use environmental performance in general as a tool to get better market performance.
There are a host of mutual funds which bill themselves as green, but there is sharp disagreement as to whether these are sound investments. Mark White is an assistant professor of commerce at the McIntyre School of Commerce at the University of Virginia. He concluded,
I conducted a study on green mutual funds available in the United States and also a set of funds that were available in Germany. And I found that over the period from December 1990 to 1993, a three-year period, that the green funds in both countries performed or significantly underperformed the overall market on a risk-adjusted basis.
However, there are managers of socially responsible funds who are achieving impressive results. Sophia Kohler is the president of Citizens Trust. I asked her whether an investment in an environmentally sound mutual fund could match that of an ordinary mutual fund.
My answer would be an unqualified yes. Obviously, our Citizens Emerging Growth Fund is an aggressive growth fund. That's how we're achieving the kind of hot results that we have, by being invested in smaller, more aggressive companies. That's the type of fund for a long-term investor wants to invest in. Say someone who's starting an IRA who is contributing to it should look at a fund like Citizens Emerging Growth Fund, again, where it had a return of almost 41% last year and an average annual return of about 24%.
Citizens Emerging Growth Fund was rated the top-performing socially responsible fund of 1995 by Business Ethics Magazine. The fact is, there are a lot of mutual funds of various shades of green whose performance varies greatly. Alicia Gravitz is executive director of Co-op America, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to use marketplace strategies to bring a social and environmental value into the economy. Co-op America publishes a list of 35 green mutual funds and rates their performance.
What you'll find when you look at that is that, like any other group of 35 mutual funds, sometimes they did better than the market, sometimes they did worse than the market. In any given market, there were some that were in the top 10% and some that were in the bottom 10%.
While conclusions about green mutual funds are mixed, there seems to be general agreement that companies, as opposed to mutual funds, that have good environmental records have significant positive performance. Having heard all of this, you're probably asking yourself, how can I make decisions about my own finances? Alicia Gravitz provides a guide.
The basic general strategies of social investors is to screen out companies who are disregarding social and environmental concerns, and to look for companies that have exemplary social and environmental records. And there's basically three strategies that you can use to do that. The first is to consider your bank. Banks obviously represent a lot of capital in this country, and unfortunately there are a lot of banks who are not taking care of their communities and who may, for example, be investing in luxury condominiums in Florida that are displacing the Everglades instead of the inner cities in their own communities. So we particularly encourage people to look at something called community banking or socially responsible banking. And there are about 5 or 10 of these banks around the company who are doing extraordinary things. And no matter where you are, you can put your money in these banks, and through the ATM system you can use them for your regular checking and saving. Now, the next strategy you can take is to invest in mutual funds. There are about 35 or 40 mutual funds who specialize in socially responsible investing. And this group of mutual funds is getting to the size where you can have a really good mutual fund strategy, and you can do as well as someone who does not take social concerns into account. So what my recommendation is people who want to do a mutual fund strategy is to get one of the resources that lists all the socially responsible investing funds, look at their performance, look at their social and environmental screens, and match the ones that you're most interested in. We publish a free guide to socially responsible investing, and we list the socially responsible banks, we list the socially responsible mutual funds, we provide worksheets so that you can plan your own goals, both your financial goals and your environmental and social goals. It's all for free, and it puts it all together for you, and you can make the decision about what works best for you.
And so how do we reach you?
You can get this for free by calling 800-713-8086. Ask for the Handbook for Responsible Investors, and we'll get that to you right away. The number again is 800-713-8086.
Elisa Gravitz is Executive Director of the nonprofit organization Co-op America. She represents a growing number of activists who are developing ways to improve the environment through the marketplace. I'm Peter Burley. We're always interested in what you have to say. So write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Or contact us via email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. Or visit us on the World Wide Web. That's www.wamc.org/env. That's www.wamc.org/env. Soon, you can hear The Environment Show at any time via the Internet on your personal computer. We'll explain it when it's up and running. Still ahead, Curly Bear Wagner, environmentalist and Native American, gives us a portrait of the Sweetgrass Prairie in Montana. And our Earth calendar sleeps through the winter with the grizzly bears. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Have places which are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's a place deep in the wilderness. Curly Bear Wagner is a Blackfoot Indian from Browning, Montana. He lives on the Sweetgrass Prairie, an area of wide-open beauty now sought after for gold mining. Wagner has been involved in the fight against development in this area for 15 years. Our portrait of place is the Sweetgrass Prairie, as seen by Curly Bear Wagner.
This story, when I was about a, the name of the story is Who Are You? And we were out on Lower St. Mary's Lake fishing with a net, whitefish on St. Mary's Lake. And he asked me, he said, who are you, son? And I looked at him and I said, well, you know, he said, I know you're Curly Bear, I know you're my nephew, but who are you? And I felt very silly because I really didn't know who I was. He said, we all know that you who you are, but do you know who you are? And I said, no, I really don't. And I was embarrassed. And so he said, I'm going to tell you who you are. And he said, you look up and you see the sun. He said, you see the sky, the mountains. He said, you see those hills, those trees. He said, you see the ground, the dirt, the rocks and the water and the four-legged and the ones that fly up above. And he said, that's who you are. He said, you're all those things. He said, you come from the earth and you'll go back. He said, always respect those things and those things will respect you. They'll be good to you. And so I always remember that. And the things that I work with today in my fight and efforts for the Sweetgrass Hills, what have you. Because, like they say, the earth is the temple of God and the tabernacle of the people. And so we've got to respect the earth and all the things within the earth, because everything out there, the trees, the four-legged, the ones that fly up above, the fish, all those things, that's kind of our library. And this is where we learned. This is how we learned how to survive from the animals, because they were here first. And so our ancestors learned from them to survive on this planet. And so it all comes back. And so we got to always keep that in mind, how important those things are. And we must always respect and honor those things as we travel, or in our everyday life, always give thanks to the sun. And just like all Indians do, the sun is very important to our people. Not many people understand that, but we always give thanks to the sun. Stop and think of what the sun gives to us. He gives us light. He makes things grow. He makes things fresh. And all the time, the sun is very important. So we're always giving thanks to the sun that way. And so all these things on this earth and the things around us, what we call the sacred hoop, are all important in our everyday lifestyle. So we always got to remember to say a little prayer or give a little thanks of what God has given to our people. Thank you.
Curly Bear Wagner is a Blackfoot Indian from Browning, Montana. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. If you've ever wished on a cold winter evening that you could crawl up in a ball and sleep till springtime, you're not alone. Many animals like grizzly bears take the winter off, not by going to Florida or Arizona, but by hibernating. Chris Servine is the Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator for the United States Fish and Wildlife Service in Missoula, Montana.
Well, as we speak, most bears in the Rocky Mountains are sound asleep. The middle of the denning season, bears have been asleep, most of them for 1 to 2 months, and they won't be up again for probably another 1 to 2 months. Their physiology changes to the point that they don't need to eat or drink, and they don't need to get rid of any waste products either, so they don't urinate or defecate. And during that time period, they're using stored fat reserves, and they're surviving on that. And they've changed their physiology to the point that they're recycling water internally so that they don't need to drink. And it's quite remarkable when you think about that, that you can get a 600 or 700 pound animal that can go 4 to 5 months without eating, drinking, urinating, or defecating.
Around autumn, grizzly bears begin to gorge themselves with food to build up their fat supplies. Servine says that when they've had their fill, they stop eating and build a den, which can be a hole in the ground, or cave, or even a hollowed-out tree. Grizzlies then get lethargic and will wait in front of their den in preparation for winter. Nearly all the dens are above 6,000 feet. Scientists suspect this is to ensure the den will be covered in a deep layer of snow to keep them warm. But exactly how the grizzlies know where and when to den is still a mystery.
I suspect that there are some cues, probably just an internal timing cue. Interestingly enough, in good weather, in January or February, in the middle of winter, on sunny days, bears will sometimes dig out of the den and sit out in the sunlight. And we call that area in front of the den the porch. Sometimes you can see these bears sitting out on their porch on these warm, clear days we sometimes get in midwinter. And probably sitting out there absorbing the sun, and as soon as the weather turns bad again, they go back inside and the snow once again seals off their den.
As with humans, the males sleep while females get up to do a little work.
I would expect that the females right about now are giving birth throughout their range. And so the cubs are actually born in mid-January when the mother is in the den. And of course the cubs are in need of food, and they start feeding on their mother's milk. So the mother's lactating and producing cubs, and yet she still doesn't need any water or food during that time period. And she can feed three and sometimes exceptionally four cubs for 2 to 3 months strictly from her fat reserves without ever drinking anything or eating anything until she leaves the den. And that's pretty remarkable.
So maybe next autumn you should follow the lead of the grizzly. Just gorge yourself, build a den, wait for the first snow, and hibernate. And who knows? Perhaps a baby will arrive at the process. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 317. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.